Well, I've already got eight people on the list, and Will Salatan, if you'll pull the, yes, Tom. Will, if you'll bring over the microphone to yourself and speak into it, thank you. Will Salatan. Push the green, but push the button and the green light will come on.
Okay. Jamie, that was wonderful. This critical theory from the right, we need more of it. Love the Charles Taylor, love your, what you've added to it. We need more of it in the public square. I have a couple of questions for you, and you can answer whichever one you like. So one is about the past. At one point you said that sort of getting to the point we are at with this modern secular morality, or secularism, depended on, the morality that we have in the secular age depended on having come through the religions of the West. And your example was the Golden Rule, I think. Now, my question to you is, do you think that that was contingent, that if we hadn't, that there was something about this particular religion that we came through that allowed us to develop this these foundations of our secular morality? Or is there something in the nature of things, in the nature of society, people, for example, that we couldn't have achieved what we've achieved if we hadn't had a religion that happened to promote that idea or be based on that idea, so that the religion of the time is just another product, as is our time, of that foundation. Another way of asking it, or this is possibly related, you talked about, you said at one point in 1500, atheism was intellectually unimaginable, and I wonder whether that's actually true. I wonder whether there's a little bit of the German white guy problem with that perhaps there was more atheism than we can see through the historical records that we tend to look at, and maybe what was there was more of a golden rule inside or outside of religion. The other question I have for you is about whether where we are is progress. You said at one point that you can't turn back secularity 3. But once you've lived on a street where other people don't believe what you believed, you can't go back to a world where everybody was homogenous and monolithic. Isn't that a good empirical way to test, to verify, and therefore to define growing up? That inability to go back intellectually means that where we are is wiser than where we were.
Did you get all that?
Yeah, great questions. So on the first one, one of the things that I think I've so appreciated about Taylor's account is that he actually takes contingency really seriously. Do you know what I mean? So it's not just a straight progress narrative. And he does. He thinks, he talks about what he calls a zigzag approach to history. It's like things could have gone differently. And in on this particular point, what all he means to show is that if you trace the particular contingent genealogy of how you get to this sort of modern moral order of universal concern, it comes through a remarkable detribalization of concern that happens in the universalism of Christianity, right? That every other is my neighbor. And that unleashes a moral imagination that couldn't have been thought before, and therefore we become indebted to that in some way. Now, he's not saying it reduces to it, but he does take that seriously. Now, whether, I don't know, is there evidence that there were more atheists before? Because Taylor's account is, it's actually a deeply communitarian account. So what he says is, look, in this enchanted world, the self was also characterized by a porosity, right? Like you had this sense that the self is porous and is open to forces, and therefore, and the community is a community of these porous selves who all hang together in a very communitarian, collective way. And therefore, the unbeliever is in a way a threat to the whole, but also the individual unbeliever, because she or he inhabits this enchanted world, doesn't think they just have the safe redoubt to say, well, I don't think this thing out there exists. To refuse this thing would have been to open yourself up and expose yourself to these other things, the demonic or whatever it might be. And so that's why there's this kind of package that makes atheistic belief rather implausible. What do you think? Does that help? I don't know. That's his account, at least. I know that he's been pushed back on some. It'd be very hard to find data, right? Given that, well, that first of all, history is told by winners, but it's very hard. It's at least a plausible account, because then what he thinks happens in modernity is now, once you sort of disenchant the world, the self is what he calls buffered. Right? So the self, you get this kind of Cartesian self, this you know, Cartesian ego, the Kantian ego, who's this sort of self-sufficient entity, who in a way now has the option of whether or not to believe X, Y, or Z, but is really sort of insulated and buffered from any threats that come with that. I find it a plausible way to make sense of some dynamics, but I'm not a historian, so I don't want to overclaim that. On the last, the growing up dynamic, is that, so what you're saying is, could we see the arrival at secular three as a maturation? Is that the idea?
Yeah, but it's because of the can't go back.
Yeah.
That's an empirical statement,
yes.
I take it, right?
Yes. Okay. And I think, I just want to be careful about this, because secular two also has a growing up narrative. Right? Secular twoism says, I grew up when I stopped believing. Now I just, you know, sort of see the way things are rationally. Secular three would have a grown-up narrative, which is, we've grown up and realized that actually belief is contestable and others believe differently than I do. And that would be, I think, what's interesting is, for someone working internal to a religious tradition like Christianity, I would also say that is kind of waking up to a reality that Christianity should affirm, which is what Augustine says, we find ourselves in the seculum, so don't pretend otherwise, right? Don't immanentize the eschaton, as Oakland would put it. Don't confuse where you are. Realize where you are and expect that kind of thing. Yeah.
But if I hear you correctly, so growing, the story that we've grown up doesn't distinguish secular two from secular three, but the phenomenon of can't go back does. Is that right?
And what you think that entails, right? So this, in secular three, you can't go back to a world in which one belief system is going to be taken to be axiomatic, right? And the default for a society. In secular two, you've grown up because you've learned to not believe. I just don't believe that. What that means is you've believed something that you get to call rational, objective, neutral, and unbiased, right? It's like there's an emperor's clothes story to be told here about secular two, whereas secular three is we all find ourselves in this space where we are owning up to the fact that we believe something ultimate, but we also realize that we can't expect that to just be the default axiomatic belief for a shared territory or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, David Brooks, pull up the mic, then Carl Cannon, and I have everyone else in the room on the list. Didn't you raise your hand?
No,
oh, I thought you went. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you said your hand up. Carl Cannon, pull the mic over. I thought, David, I saw you go like this.
Is it on now? Professor, you quoted someone. I didn't get the. He said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. Julian Barnes. That reminded me of a similar quote, and I don't want to be like one of these Washington people who says, as I said on Meet the Press, quoting myself. But I actually don't. I don't know who said this. Carmody and I have had a debate over it for several years. Maybe someone in this room said, if you did, please raise your hand. But it was in Key West after a long several hours of drinking. And we were one of the participants in the drinking and the conversation was Christopher Hitchens. And when he left, someone said, maybe me, we don't know, that Hitchens' philosophy seemed to be God doesn't exist, and I'm really pissed off at him. But in a more serious thing, if you take this period of time from 1500 to 2000, it seems that one explanation, the obvious explanation for it, the secular explanation, if you will, is that there's been this inexorable discovery of scientific phenomena mostly, but other truths that were the source was unknown before, and they were thought to be unknowable. They were attributed to God. And that this, and what a person, a non-believer, would say is this is sort of a steady, it's progress, and it's a steady and inexorable march of history, and that these polls we're seeing about these millennials, you know, a lot of them spiritual but not religious, that is a trend that we're never going back, that this is the march of Western progress, or I don't know if it's progress, but that's the way things are going. You seem to, without directly taking issue with that, maybe challenge that view, and I would ask you to exploit a little more on that. This marketplace of ideas thing's kind of fun, you know. We're journalists, that's cool, but is that just a temporary thing and it's the road to Europe, whatever.
So I'm a great fan of air conditioning and indoor plumbing, and sure, there's without question there is a certain kind of progress story to be told in modernity, and I don't think any of this has to discount that. What's interesting is when you actually ask, you hinted at this, I think, a little bit in your question, is what if you start asking questions of what counts as progress for humanity, then you're burying down into what Taylor calls the basement levels of commitments about what you think counts as flourishing, for example, and so on. And I think that's where things get a little bit more contestable. At the very least, we know that, in fact, what unleashed, one reason why, so I've loved Christopher Hitchens for years, right up until the point that he started talking about religion. He's so much better about literature and politics than he is about religion. Because then I would say he devolves into spin rather than a take for some reason. What you can't tell is just some sort of simplistic, dichotomous, binary option here between the religious and scientific progress, since in many ways we know that what unleashed the scientific endeavor itself were religious communities that were invested in that, right? Both Muslim and Christian, I would say. And so, I don't think we have to feel a tension between those two things. What I'm contesting is a maturation story that equates maturity with unbelief, disbelief, right? Wake up and smell the disenchantment kinds of stories, right? And again, this is where I feel like there are just a lot of interesting exceptions to the rule. I didn't build it in here, but there's a fantastic short story by David Foster Wallace that was published posthumously in The New Yorker, simply called All That.
All what?
All That. You can find it online. And in which there is this older adult narrator talking about a younger self who believes in magic. And he says, and what's interesting is he doesn't look back at his younger self and discount it. He says, I look back and see birthed there a religious reverence that characterized my whole life. And that even atheism is its own form of worship. And you know, he has this really interesting analysis where he refuses the maturation story. And again, what intrigues me is, and it gets published in The New Yorker, right? Interesting little exception to the rule that you would expect of kind of trenchant secularization. Does that help? Yeah. There's a longer conversation there with bourbon, probably.
Naomi Schaefer Riley, please pull the mic over. We're here on the right.
What's on?
Yep.
I wanted to ask. Sorry, do this so I can actually look at you while I'm talking. I wanted to dig a little deeper into this sequestration question that I'm sure a lot of people are interested in for political reasons. I guess if we were having this conversation about 10 or 15 years ago, the sequestration would have been a matter of the elites not believing and the people on the ground in flyover country believing. I think a lot of the work that has come out in the last decade or so has suggested that that is an incomplete and maybe inaccurate picture of what's going on in America today. That is that a lot of the religious belief in the country is now among the middle and upper classes, and it's the working class and people who are living in poverty who have the least amount of religion in their lives. So I guess what I'm curious about is how are we to think about the sequestration now? And a second kind of part to that I've been thinking more about is the Peter Berger question. So if, as he suggested, we are or we were at some point a nation of Indians run by the Swedes, if we're now a nation of Swedes run by the Indians, maybe, does that mean that the elite belief in religion is going to start to trickle back down? I mean, are we headed? I guess one question is whether the elites have any sway, whether their church going or more frequent church going habits are going to be able to trickle back down. And I don't know whether there is a political answer to all this, but I'm sort of curious about the overall picture here, how we should think about our zip codes these days.
Yeah, and I would be fascinated to just hear others work on this. This is very much sort of off-the-cuff reflections on my part. I guess I'm not convinced. We do know that sort of religious participation seems to be more highly represented in sort of educated elites than we might have expected, and that there has been a kind of secularization of poor and working classes in ways that we might not have guessed. I don't know that that at all translates into a confidence that those elites who are religiously active now constitute a majority of the elite, though, right? That's not true, yeah. So I think you can still safely say, I mean, in many ways, it confirms Hunter's work, but in this sense that I think people inhabit intellectual milieus and environments that are significantly dominated by one sort of set of beliefs and expectations that make it increasingly difficult for people to imagine the alternative. I guess maybe, probably, I would say one of the most intense examples of that today is the university, right? So if you think of it, the last bastion of the most confident modernity and secularism too is in many ways still the university. Now, even though there's all kinds of exceptions to the rule on the margins of that, right, there's still the default, unwritten, scripted orthodoxy of the university is confidently expecting this secularization story, right? And so, and insofar as those are still the incubators of then cultural influencers, I don't know. I guess I don't see the sample representation of those elites who are practicing religious folk being significant enough yet to have sort of cascaded and shaped, you know, what's happening in Hollywood studios or newsrooms. I'll let you guys tell me about that. But there's something. Now, are you asking a demographic question too about whether you could imagine us getting to that point?
Well, I guess if religious belief is increasingly being concentrated in these upper classes, even if it's not yet constituting a majority. I mean, isn't that kind of belief then going to have more of an effect? That's going to be characterizing more of the way we practice religion than I think what a lot of people stereotypically have in mind.
And I would say too, my hunch though is that, let's say those religious folk who find themselves in those sectors are also probably well aware of the realities of secular three, and therefore the way they will engage those public conversations and seek to persuade is going to be very different than the kind of slash and burn apologetics that usually happens in other sectors, which have no chance of having any sort of success in shaping cultural or changing the cultural conversation, I think. Well, the one piece I think that I also just don't know enough about is the real shifts that have taken place in sort of working class and poor religiosity. And it strikes me that one of the things that has gone away is what we might call, for lack of a better term, catechesis, right? There's just a certain failure of catechesis in the churches, and therefore people don't even feel the tensions that they ought to feel sometimes about that. But again, I admittedly am, as a complete amateur, trying to understand the Trump phenomenon a little bit. Yeah.
We knew his name would come up soon.
Yes.
Paul Edwards, if you'll pull the mic over, and while you're doing that, one of the reasons we're doing this session with Dr. Smith, by the way, is I have lunch twice a year with eight of your colleagues, and we talk about what are the topics we want to talk about, the next faith angle. And Carl Cannon, after the killings in San Bernardino, we wanted to do a session on that, which we'll do tomorrow morning. But also, Carl reminded us soon after that, the New York Post, big headline, "Keep God Out of It." Do you remember that? Was it or the Daily News? Or?
Yeah.
It was the Daily News, and so that. But, and Carl made the point, this is a little unusual. He said, remember, Carl, you said, I know this newsroom is secular, but the idea you would just do a headline, please don't bring God into discussion, was something new, and that's why we actually came up with this topic for Jamie. Paul Edwards, you're up over here, and then Miranda.
Jamie, I'm guessing you're familiar with the Benedict option. Does this mean something to you?
Yeah.
And I was wondering how that fits into what you're thinking about here. So if you might, I could talk about it, but maybe you could explain a little bit about the Benedict option that's being discussed and how it fits into a particular retreat from secularization.
Yeah. So at least we found something I can say off the record. Only because Rod Dreher is a friend. Yeah, I think so. Can we just talk about it out loud for a sec?
Yeah.
So the Benedict option, how many have heard this phrase? I'd just be curious to, oh, wow, okay. All right, hence he got the book contract.
You want this off the record? He can handle it.
All right, fine, okay, on the record.
I want to quote you.
So the Benedict option is a certain response of religious conservatives who are sort of, I would say, waking up to the fact that American culture generally is not going to form them in faith. Apparently this is a revelation, but and therefore, by the way, it seems so clearly catalyzed by the Supreme Court gay marriage decision, which to me is one of the reasons why I feel like it's suspect. I'm not deciding either way on that. I'm just saying that there's a certain reactionariness about it that I find narrow and uninteresting. What they advocate is, it comes of course from Benedictine tradition of monastic life. It really is an allusion to the final sentence of Alistair MacIntyre's famous work After Virtue, in which he says we are waiting now for another Benedict, right, to come along and give us a society that actually forms virtue and character and so on and so forth. And so the Benedict option I see, as I understand it, I do think it's misunderstood often, is about prioritizing an intentionality within Christian communities, in this case, to be much more intentional about formation and so on, and less confident that they will be able to steer, shape, and probably dominate wider cultural conversation. So it's actually a refusal of the culture wars as well. What I just find a bit frustrating about it is, again, the particular reactionary point about marriage that I do think is the live option. It also comes off as alarmist and despairing in ways that I find completely unhelpful. After the break, I'm going to give you, I got to interview Charles Taylor a couple years ago, and one of the things that just so struck me is that hope is his dominant posture. And I think that's really important. I think if you actually have the long game in perspective here, if you have the long history in perspective, You know, I spend most of my time reading St. Augustine in the 5th century, and nothing surprises me. Like, nothing surprises me today. And so I don't feel like, oh my goodness, the sky is falling because the Supreme Court decision or something like that. It's like, what did you, there's a different set of expectations about that. Finally, I would say what Rod is advocating as this new thing that we should be doing just sounds like what the church was always supposed to be doing. So I don't, it comes off as a little bit like, here's the next great thing, and it turns out it's only because we failed to do what we were supposed to be doing. So Rod's a friend, and what's odd for me is how much he sort of draws on my own work to sort of articulate this, and yet I myself feel a certain distance from it because it comes with a grumpy, alarmist despair that I don't really want to be associated with.
I'm so delighted that was on the record. There was nothing controversial.
Well, that will be one book blurb I'm not writing.
That was very helpful because I'm giving a talk next month and I discussed the Benedict option. I will now quote you.
Great.
To reaffirm my own point. Miranda Kennedy and then James Hunter. Miranda, over here.
Yeah, so I was fascinated by your description of having to convince your students of how seductive the like rationalist, Darwinistic version of history is. Yeah. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
You had to.
So notice, I'm working with a certain student population that, I teach at Calvin College. In many ways, the windows are wide open. You know, we're sort of engaged. But many of these students, you know, significant percentage of students are coming out of K-12 Christian education as well. And without being at all reactionary, Grand Rapids, Michigan, we sometimes call Jerusalem, because there's there's still pretty thick plausibility structures in the region where you could get away with it. Do you know what I mean? So for me, it's like some days I wish Calvin College was a college at the University of Michigan, so that we could inhabit both of those spaces and feel the cross pressure a little more intensely. Mm-hmm. So in that context, I'm trying to get them to actually, I'm trying to foster an intellectual honesty where they realize, A, this is saying a lot of true things about human beings and human origins, but to also just feel the compellingness of this, right? Like it's a very adequate story to explain a lot. And so I want them to feel that precisely so they're not then sent out living in some sort of oblivious bubble.
Right, because they haven't like chosen the Benedict option themselves yet. They're just informed.
Exactly.
So I'm so interested because having like grown up with that particular narrative, the one that you have to convince them is seductive, you know, now seeing inside a Christian world how totally opposite the worldviews are, I can understand why perhaps we are where we are, sure. You know, politically and all kinds of other divisions. And I wonder if you think about ways that we could break down some of those divisions better in our lives, I mean, just inside American culture.
So in some ways, it does come down to the how.
You
rather than just the what.
Book.
Yeah, right. And which is also why it's kind of called How Not to Be Secular with the parentheses. Because, I mean, I actually think there's ways in which all of us need to learn how to be secular, right? But then I'm saying as for Christian communities, religious communities, there are also ways that you want to learn to not be that. And to me, this is breaking that down is exactly the space I want to live in. I had a fantastic experience a week ago tonight. I was in a conversation in New York with Kwame Anthony Appiah. Is that a name that some of you know? Ghanaian English philosopher at NYU, ethicist in the law school, advocate of what he calls cosmopolitanism. Really significant book that people were talking about a few years ago. Identifies as an atheist, and we had a public conversation here's the thing. They frame it as a debate about pluralism, toleration, and the common good between the Christian and the atheist. I'm like, I'm not interested in a debate. I'm much more interested in, first of all, showing how much we have in common, and in many ways, trying to deconstruct the caricatures that I think a lot of those folks would have had about Christianity to say, no, here's why I affirm the goods of toleration, here's why I affirm pluralism, here's why I affirm the common good, here's all the ways that we overlap and share concerns. And then getting to a point where I could push him, it was actually, it was a blast. I loved it because on the one hand, he articulates this vision of this cosmopolitanism, which is a perfect expression of the modern moral order. And then if you start asking him about the moral sources that would really fund that, basically what he starts talking about is being raised as a Methodist in Ghana. Do you know what I mean? And the sort of the intuitions and sort of spiritual inclinations that he absorbed, which, by the way, is the replaying of the kind of Western story in some ways. So, and we came away, and I think it's interesting. So it was co-sponsored by Christian groups on campus, the secularist group on campus, the humanist society, a Muslim society, student society. And I think some of the kind of atheist, secularist, and Christian groups were looking for these fireworks, right? That's why you bill it as a debate. We completely disappointed them because we absolutely had a blast, had so much, I actually just was completely in awe that I was on the stage with him, and modeled, I hope, a mode of ad hoc collaboration without pretending we didn't have ultimate differences and trying to, I just feel like there's a lot of room and hunger for that. I have, for all the stories you might tell about the university, I've actually only had mostly great experiences of that kind of thing. So, and I do feel like you all steward spaces that could do the same, and are doing the same in some ways. Yeah. Does that speak to your...
I guess it's, I'm not sure I entirely agree that we are consistently doing it, but I mean, I think that there, I'm interested that you think that there's a hunger. Because I do think there's a very strong hunger for debate, like you said, that people want the clashes.
Yeah.
And it's boring when you hear people who are supposed to be on opposite sides kind of coming together. Yeah. And it's not necessarily about agreeing. It's also just about, I was asking more about hearing one another's viewpoints, because that
So you're not sequestered, so you actually bump into it.
Yeah, the sequestration happens in so many levels of society that you just...
Yes.
I just, for so long, did not know
what,
for instance, like Christian evangelicals actually
believed
in so many, in their hearts, in their minds, at home. I just had a politicized version of that that got... transmuted into the public square.
Yeah, and do you remember that Molly Worthen piece a few weeks ago in the Times on Sunday about, for example, the Veritas Forum and the Augustine Collective, these movements on Ivy League campuses, which I think their goal is to just make sure that the intellectual tradition of Christianity is heard in those elite university spaces. But I agree, who was the sociologist who wrote The Big Sort? Right, that we keep sifting ourselves out, and to overcome that, I think, is a huge challenge. Yeah. Bill Bishop, that's
Bill
it. Yes.
Quickly on this point, Paul Edwards.
Appiah. I've heard him talk about Paul as a cosmopolitan.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The Apostle Paul, very strong in his thinking.
Yeah. So. Galatians 2. There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor woman. Yeah.
James Hunter, you're up next. What we're doing is we're moving the break up to 10:45 instead of 10:30. So, James, you'll take us into the break, and then we're going to have a 15-minute break.
Great.
So, James, you have a mic on?
Yeah. There we go. Okay. Mike, thanks. And, Jamie, thank you for a terrific lecture. I want to push back, though, on Taylor.
Yeah, great.
I mean, who's anyone to take on Charles Taylor? But I think that it's certain... important points he needs to be pushed back against. His strength is as a phenomenologist.
Yeah.
In talking about religious experience and religious belief, and the supernova he describes, I think, is a fair description of what happens in the late modern world in the private sphere. Okay? In personal experience. But culture, and this is really important here, culture is not reducible to individual belief.
Yeah.
Culture is not the sum total of individual belief. Culture is a powerful symbolic order, independent of what people believe or don't believe, and it's always embedded in powerful institution. And this speaks to Will's question earlier about atheists in the 1500s. 1500s. Were there more atheists back in the 1500s than we think? Well, it's an interesting empirical question, but at some level it doesn't matter, because the symbolic order and the dominant institutions back then were infused with a religious imagery, with religious signifiers, powerful symbols. There may have been more atheists, but they probably wouldn't have gathered much, and they weren't politicized. And again, there may have been, but we probably not much of that. So in the public sphere, however, the world of finance, say, or of medical research, or of political campaigning, whatever, this is not a sphere or a culture of contested, well, certainly it's contested, but in terms of the mechanics, the logic of running a campaign or of doing medical research. Whatever someone's personal beliefs may be, the frameworks of understanding, the frameworks of action, the rules by which people operate are defined by a technical rationality that is disenchanted, that is secular, and it's not really, as I say, contested. An airline pilot who is a Pentecostal snake handler can hold his or her beliefs as long as they don't bring them into the cockpit.
Okay. Or the snakes.
Okay. There's a movie about this.
Snakes on the plane.
That's right. There is a movie about that. So, so the culture of the public sphere, which again, disenchanted, oriented toward a kind of technical, functional rationality, it is totalizing. It operates with a latent epistemology that is positivist, an ethics that is utilitarian, a teleology that is problem-oriented, but with no serious hypergoods that anyone could agree upon. And this provides a plausibility structure for a kind of exclusive secularism.
And the question is?
So the question is, given this, I mean, again, I think what Taylor describes is accurate insofar as it bears on the on private life, personal experience, individual belief, and so on. I don't think it extends into the symbolic order and institutional realities of the public sphere. So, and part of the political dilemma of our global politics and our even national politics is the pushback against that totalizing secular ethos. Is that a fair critique of Taylor? You seem to be an enthusiast of his, and I don't want to make you a proxy for him, but
yeah,
I would love to hear your views of that.
No, I think you're on to something. I mean, I guess a couple things come to mind. One is, I mean, you want your pilot to work that way, right? But so it seems like there is a certain kind of, I hate the term, but there's a certain kind of compartmentalization that would be welcome, it seems to me. Right? Because I don't know if I want the dynamics that get the plane up and going, I want us to stay within that logic when we're doing that. On the other hand, I guess I've always thought that Taylor feels the extent to which the wider symbolic universe has been dominated by the disenchantment. At least I can feel that. But again, I think he thinks that's more localized. I mean, you're interested in the particularly influential sort of elite culture-shaping centers in which this would be much more true, too, right? And I think it's interesting, when I interviewed Taylor, he says he started thinking about a secular age in the 60s when he was at Oxford. He knew he was already going to write a secular age in the 60s at Oxford because it was his experience of the university, in which he found himself in this university, and he says, why is it what I believe is so unbelievable to everybody else that's around me? So I think you could actually grant a lot of the account. By the way, this would also become a way to assess the degree of assimilation of religious communities to that technical rationality, utilitarianism, right? That in a way, because we simply play along with the logic of the market or whatever it might be, we unwittingly get sucked into seeing that as the overall logic, that society is a market or something like that. And I think that's right. We've underestimated the extent to which disenchantment. We all are disenchanted now in that sense. It is true. I think probably Taylor is best when he's trying to, sometimes he says what he's trying to do is describe what it feels like, right? And that's a very individual sort of subjective experience. What does it feel like to believe in this age? What does it feel like to not believe in this age? But I welcome the conversation. I need to think more about that. That's great.
Before we go on the break, Andrew Miller had one of these. So if you turn the mic on, you'll take us into the break, Andrew. You had a quick intervention.
I did, yeah. Is that on? Yeah, I just enjoyed your talk very much. I just thought it was important. I wanted to just offer, I guess, a defense of secularism very briefly, or at least a critique of your critique of secularism, because I think although you hurried through it, you kind of elided things a little bit. Of course, for the reasons you say, as an account of history or the end of history, it hasn't turned out to be very prophetic, and as a aggressive sort of program, it's possibly inadvisable right now. But as a sort of hope or as a long-term agenda, I guess a lot of convinced secularists would say that, on the contrary, the events of the last 20 years have made it all the more urgent as a creed.
Yeah, no, and this is the conversation we need to have, because what I would say in reply is, I think one of the things we are feeling in this country right now is actually the effects of a secularization which has eroded the sorts of institutions that used to actually foster civic camaraderie and life in ways that we've lost. So for all the sort of, religion is a source of evil kinds of arguments, I just want to meet them with an account of how much religious institutions were responsible for the formation of, character, habits, dispositions and inclinations that actually also made us better citizens. And so if secularization entails the erosion of those kinds of institutions, what we will get is the paucity of our civic life as we're currently experiencing it. Now, I would say, remember, though, even as someone coming from a religious tradition, I can actually be a pretty ardent advocate of secularity 3 as a healthy realization. In fact, I've been spending a lot of time with British theologian and ethicist Oliver O'Donovan, who's fascinating work on this history, in which he says, but at one point he says, the society which is most Christian will be most secular, because it will actually be the one that is most attentive to how penultimate our reality is, and so it will be least inclined to sort of invest the penultimate with ultimate sort of significance. I feel like one of the things that's happening, Jody Bottom's work has I think diagnosed this, is precisely when you lose the transcendent and eternal, now what has to happen is everybody has to turn the penultimate into the ultimate. Mm. And so now our political identities, our political allegiances are characterized by a kind of religious fervor that almost makes it impossible for us to do collaboration in that space.
I guess if you were a secularist, you'd say about this question of sort of post-religious morality, in the absence of the ghost of religion and God, that, like the French Revolution, is too early to say. I mean, it's much too early to say. This moment has only really existed for a very short space in human history.
Sure. One last thing, though. This is totally the conversation I want to have for the next 5 years, because I think what has struck me is in secularist accounts of morality, they also still tend to imagine morality as primarily a set of beliefs and expectations. And what's missing, this is actually the perfect segue to this afternoon, what I think is missing in secular accounts of morality is precisely an account of habit. And in order to talk about habits of disposition, you need communities of character. This is James Hunter's work. Now, maybe the secularist has an account of where those communities are and what they're doing, but I feel like we haven't had that conversation yet. Yeah, it's a great point.
Tom? Go ahead, Tom, over here.
Okay. So right before the break, Jamie, you categorized yourself as a healthy advocate of secularization three. So when you say you're an advocate for a certain type of secular, that kind of obligates you to pronounce on issues of public and even political debate, right? So huge issue is the meaning of religious liberty and how to interpret the First Amendment, mandating that Congress not establish a religion or limit the exercise thereof. I was just reading this interview with Charles Taylor, in which he talks about open secularism versus closed secularism, and he says that open secularism, instead of being the regime that defends everyone's, closed secularism, instead of being the regime that defends everyone's freedom of conscience, whether religious or non-religious, it becomes a secularism wary of religion and always ready to set limits to it. Non-religion becomes the common principle, although you tolerate religion if it stays in its place. That sounds very much like what Potter Stewart argued in 1960, saying that the government, if the government takes too strict a view of the separation of church and state, it actually elevates secularism to the level of a rival religion, and therefore, neutrality as far as the role of the government in this issue is, more complicated than it might at first appear. So what implications does the fact that we live in this era of contested belief mean for the neutrality of the state when it comes to expressions of religion?
I'm trying to think of another court decision, but I'm not going to be able to retrieve that on the top of my head. Taylor, in that same interview, advocates then what he calls an open secularism, right? So it is a form of disestablishment, but it's not one that asks people to leave their religious identities at the door of this proverbial naked public square, right? You make room for people to bring who they are in their fullness into the public square. And that's what I'm envisioning, right? And the state then, the goal of the state's responsibility is to be fair, not neutral. Now, that can be a weasel word, obviously, and that we'll fight a lot about what fairness looks like. But I think it's the difference between, Jerry and I were talking about laïcité in France, which is a very, very live option in Quebec as well, where Taylor's working from. What's interesting is it's precisely in societies in which religion had such a totalizing institutional expression in the church sort of running things that you also then get the alternative of laïcité, which is this ardent secularism endorsed by the state, basically. And I think religious liberty that's imagined in the kind of secular three middle is one that obviously does not establish a church, does not establish a particular religion, but is making space for people to come with the thickness of their religious commitments. It does then have to be a truly pluralist space. So I think another way to frame the tension here is between secularism as actually a very homogenizing agenda versus a secularity three that makes room for a genuine pluralism. The other piece that comes to mind is the limits of the freedom of conscience model is that it entirely envisions religious belief as this individual phenomenon, right, of what I believe. What I think we are wrestling through right now over the last few years is what we might call institutional religious freedom, right? Do bodies have a kind of freedom? Do you know Stanley Carlson Thies?
Sure.
the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance is saying, we can't just think about religious freedom as your permission in private to believe what you want on weekends. If religion is a way of life that is shared by communal bodies, we also have to find healthy ways to make room for those bodies to live out that. And that's what I'm imagining as a good thing. I feel like I'm not answering your question, though.
You're beginning to answer it. You're just not taking it to the degree that I wanted you to take it to, which is to pronounce on the, you know, the religious liberty. I mean, Ted Cruz has said that this is a religious liberty election. He's the one that has made this argument most forcefully that the state has to allow people to pray in school, you know, and to not interfere with the religious beliefs in the public square as well as in the private square. And I'm wondering if, you know, does that jive with?
Yeah, that's messy, isn't it? Because there, I feel like what I'm trying to think through is if that's what they mean by religious liberty, what they actually mean is they're still quite allied to the statecraft as the expression of this, right? Whereas I think if you had, I'm not pronouncing on this, but if you take, say, Catholic social teaching about subsidiarity, right, which means that there are all kinds of layers and levels and spheres of culture beyond the state that are significant for society as a whole, then I would say that what's crucial is to secure the religious liberty for those institutional expressions to be who they are. I guess I'm less inclined to imagine that religious liberty means re-pristinating the public schools to do what they used to do when we thought everybody was a Christian. I hope this is not getting me in trouble somewhere. But yeah, it just doesn't seem. Again, this is why O'Donovan, when he says the most Christian state is the most secular, is actually it recognizes the contested nature of the seculum. On the other hand, his partner Joan Lockwood O'Donovan, who's also a Christian legal scholar, has written a fascinating paper on why the establishment of the Church of England has been the best thing for religious minorities, right? So it's very messy in how we want to think of it. If the good is making room for communities to pursue their faith in ways that are meaningful, but also allow them to contribute to the public sphere. That's what I'm sort of looking for. I do think there is a certain legitimacy. People could feel like some decisions and policies over the last few years have impinged on the religious liberty of institutions in particular. Mm-hmm. But that's different than sort of prayer in schools kind of dynamic. I should tell you, I'm Canadian, so you have to take all of this with a grain of salt, and your fights are a little bit different than my fights in a way, yeah.